We are... Sorry? Oh, that. Right. Fine. This also. We are in Perek Zayin, Chapter 7. We introduced the Perek last week. Talked about how Perek Vav set us up for this. The war with Yericho, the decision not to take from the spoils, the discussion about who decided they shouldn't be able to take from the spoils. We talked about how they're on a high. They've just conquered Yericho, this major fortress, and they're feeling very good about themselves. Yehoshua in general has had no problems. Everything's going fine. People are listening to him. Hashem is doing miracles for him. And then we started the discussion about this parak because we read Pasuk Aleph, we read the opening sentence. I do want to note also that the learning today is dedicated in memory of Yitzchak Elazar ben Mordechai, whose yard site is this week was actually yesterday. So in the opening Pasuk of this parak, the opening sentence of the chapter, we read, Vayimalu b'nei Yisrael mal b'cherim, that b'nei Yisrael are guilty of mal, which is trespass. Trespass not in the sense of crossing a physical boundary, but in the sense of using something that belongs to somebody else. They are guilty of using the cherim, the property that had been set aside. Who did it? Vayikach Achan ben Karmi ben Zavdi ben Zerach lematei Yehuda min hacherem. This fellow Achan, son of Karmi, son of Zavdi, son of Zerach, he is the one who takes from the spoils, but the Jewish people as a whole are held responsible. And we noted the idea of listing his whole lineage may be understood, as the Medrash says, as a statement about his family. His family is to be degraded because of what he did. And it also plays into the general theme of this chapter, the theme of collective responsibility. So if someone does something, it's like the whole unit of which he's a member has done it as well. So all of them are dragged into this. But Hashem is angry at B'nai Yisrael, at the Jews as a whole. He's going to punish the Jews as a whole. And in source number one on your sheet today, you see I just summarized five different approaches we brought last week to the discussion about collective responsibility. The idea that the nation as a whole is going to be held responsible. The first approach we had was simply, I am part of the group. Meaning, it's not that I did anything wrong. If somebody in the group sinned, I didn't. But because this individual sinned, that means the group has sinned, and the group is going to suffer as a result. The second is more a statement of guilt. I should have tried to stop them. I didn't try to stop them, therefore I am responsible. Third, I am influenced by the one who has sinned. I am part of the Avera, because now I am part of a society that does this. It influences me. The fourth idea was that it's not really a punishment as much as Hashem says, I'm not going to protect the community anymore. Because part of the community has sinned, they're no longer worthy of my protection, and now they're vulnerable. And then the last approach is that this is just part of life. That Hashem designs a world in which, yes, on a very low level, and when you're dealing with the issues between one person and another, it's entirely possible that one person will do something and somebody else will suffer for it, and it's just mazel. That's the way it goes. And we're going to see this week how that plays into what happens with the Jews in our parak. But the Jews indeed do get blamed. Actually, we'll see it now. I bumped it up to the beginning of the parak. I forgot about that. So here, we're going to see the Jews go to war against the nation of Ai, and we're going to see them lose the war, and it will be blamed on the fact that Achan took from the spoils. So taking these ideas that we see in source number one to explain why the community should be responsible for an individual's sin, two of these are directly applied to the case at hand. First, the idea that the sin reflects a national failing. Mitzudas David takes this approach. He says, it's the fault of the Jews as a whole because they should have created a society in which it was unthinkable to take from the spoils. If it's been dedicated and you say, this is cherem, this is for God, it's not for anybody else, no one should have even been able to dream of doing.
But only one person took from the spoils, not 20.
Right.
Two.
Right.
One. So maybe they did have the fault.
But you just have a flawless system.
Right.
Every single person.
Correct. So that's a weakness in what he's saying. Rav David Altshuler, the Mitzudas David, is really, you know, making a very strong demand. Can you really expect 100% compliance no matter what you do? So Radak has a slightly different take. If you take a look at source number two, Rav David Kimchi offers the following. Shimru min hacherem. This is a pasuk that was in the previous parak, the previous chapter, when they were told, guard yourselves from the cherem, guard from the spoils. Shimru atzmechem, vishimru ish es achiv. Guard yourselves and guard each other. In other words, you have to make sure that nobody else does it. You have to put people out there responsible to watch, however you're gonna do this. Closed circuit TV. And therefore he said, Israel has sinned. The problem was that they didn't pay attention to making sure that no one would be able to take. In other words, Achan didn't have to sneak in order to get it. He actually just walked right in. No one prevented it from happening. That's the way Radak understands it. So as far as this view goes, Radak Mitzudas David, the reason why the Jews as a whole are going to suffer because of what Achan did is because the sin reflected a national weakness. That's one approach. But there's a second approach, which I think tells us a lot about the transformation that the nation is undergoing in this parak and in this series of prakim. And that is the approach of, you're a nation now, and you don't get to say that whatever one person does doesn't reflect your identity. It's sort of like the flip side of what we do all the time. Right? There's a news report about someone who did something bad, fill in the blank, right? And some reporter mentions that the person is Jewish. Right? It generally comes in with certain types of crimes. They'll say that he was Jewish. They mention it with other religions that I ever noticed, but for us, we get it singled out. The truth of the matter is, though, that this position we're about to see says you're not entitled to get offended by that. You're not entitled to take umbrage. The fact that they're signaling out that the person is Jewish is because, yes, a Jew did this, and therefore you should accept not a sense of guilt, because you're not the one who did it, but a sense of responsibility because the group has done it. If one Jew did it, everybody did it. And you'll see here, Malbim is going to take this approach. Malbim takes this approach, Rabag takes it, Abarbanel takes it. Take a look at source number 3. He says, Modia, this text that we read that says that the Jews have sinned informs us, Ki kol Yisrael kshurim kiguf echad, that all Israel are bound together as one body. He said the relationship between each individual and the community is like the relationship between a part of the body and the body as a whole. He says, just like if one part of the body gets sick, or one part of the body gets a defect, the whole body is sick. The whole body now has a flaw. It's considered as though the nation as a whole has sinned. They've all done it, and therefore, they're going to suffer the results. That's the idea that he sees here. He also adds a second element, which is a separate note that Abarbanel and Rabag also do, which is that this isn't direct punishment as much as it is removal of Hashem's protection. The nation isn't worthy of that protection. So he writes, Sheish havdel bein ha'onesh haba befoal, ubein ha'onesh haba yidei siluk hashgacha. He says there's a difference between punishment that comes actively and punishment that comes by removal of divine supervision. His reason for bringing this element is because there's sort of a problem you have to ask when you read this story, which is, Achan isn't going to die in this war. Right? In other words, he's the one who actually did it. He's the one who took from the Cherem. They're going to go to war against this nation called Ai. And we're going to find out that in fact there are casualties in it, but he's not one of them. It's one thing for me to accept that the nation as a whole should suffer because, after all, he's part of the nation and the nation has sinned, but why doesn't he die in the battle? So for that, he gives this answer, Malam gives this answer, that it wasn't an act of punishment. Hashem doesn't say, people took from the spoils and therefore I'm sending a bolt of lightning and it's going to strike this one, and this one. It's simply that he says, I'm not going to protect them. And because he says, I am not protecting the nation, the result of that lack of supervision is that some people are going to die, but Achan may not be the one. God isn't zapping him personally. He's simply saying, I'm not protecting the nation as a whole. You follow the idea? That's his explanation. But what this is saying on a broader level, and the point that I really wanted to emphasize here, is that the Jews are learning what it's like to be a nation in their land. We read last week the Gemara in Sanhedrin that says, once you cross the Jordan, you have mutual responsibility. You're no longer just this group of individuals or even separate tribes. Now you're a nation. You have to accept that that means that you're going to have joint responsibility. One of you does something, all of you have done it. And that's part of this sort of maturity process that they're going through. Okay. That's all building off of the pasuk that we saw last week about how Achan took from the spoils and the nation is going to be held responsible. But there's one other piece to this introduction to the perek, and that is Psukim Bet Vegimel, sentences 2 and 3. Oh, you know what? I'm sorry, Ralbag also. I brought you Ralbag. He's saying the same thing as Malvin, but I like the way he phrased it. So if you just take a look at source number 4 before we go on. Ralbag writes, Efshar mizulas avel, sheyimashech b'mikre onesh ma libanim b'chatas ha'avos. He says it's possible, without any avel, without anything inappropriate, any impropriety, it is possible for punishment to go from, to apply to children for the sin of the parents, which is an idea that we discuss a lot, because in the Torah you find, on the one hand, ish pechat oyumas, a person dies with his own sins, and then on the other hand, pokeid avon avos al banim, that Hashem brings the sins of the parents upon the children. How do you reconcile the two? The Gemara offers solutions, but what Ralbag says here is, of course that can happen. Ki kamo zeh lo yi avo aval klal. He says there's nothing wrong with that. V'hamashal, he says, for example, im chata adam l'malchus, let's say a person sinned against the government. Okay, not a Jewish thing, but a person committed some crime. Right? V'anshu bedin lavod memono. And they punished him. They tried him in court. And the punishment was that he was going to lose his money. So hina yagya mizeh onesh lebanav, his kids are going to suffer for it. Sheyiyu anim, they're going to be poor. Velo yirshu davar minichsei aviyam, and they won't inherit anything from their parents. Sheyiyu asidim lirasham, the ones that they would have, that which they would have received, they're now not going to receive. His point is, it's just a natural consequence of life. When one person suffers, those who are connected to that person are going to suffer as well. It's just the way the world works. So that's the take of Ralbag. You could distinguish between what Ralbag is saying and what Malbim is saying. I don't want to get too much into a discussion of the fine points of them. And there is room to distinguish. But okay. Back to Psukim Bet Vegimel that we were headed for. Vayishlach Yoshua anashim miricho ha'ai. Yoshua sent men out of the camp in Yericho to Ai. Asher im Beis Oven, Mikedem LeBeis El, Ai, which is next to Beis Oven, which is east of Beit El. We get these locations. Potentially there was another place called Ai as well, and therefore the Pasuk wants to tell us it's this Ai, not another one. There's another reason to mention Mikedem LeBeit El, but we'll come back to that. Vayomer Alehem Lemor, and he said to them the following instructions, Alu, V'raglu es ha'aretz, ascend and seek out, investigate the land. Be Miraglim. Right? Miraglim, this is something now that Jews do routinely. You know, in the Midbar it was a big deal. But they sent Miraglim to Yericho before crossing in, and now they're sending Miraglim to Ai. Vayalu ha'anashim, vayiraglu es ha'ai. So the men went up, and in fact they investigated Ai. Anything odd in Pasuk Bet?
Why are you saying ha'ai? Does that matter? Is that just a...
No, that's just the way they're identified.
Well, it says et ha'aretz, which will see the land, and they said they just went to Ai.
Right, they didn't do what they were told to do. Usually we find repetition like this in Yehoshua to indicate they did what they were told, right? If you remember when they crossed the Jordan. So this one goes then, and then this one goes then, and then they actually did it. Here, we're told they went to Ai. They didn't actually go throughout the area. That's number one.
They just went to a specific place.
Mm-hmm. Number two, take a look at Pasuk Gimel. Vayashuvu el Yehoshua. They came back to Yehoshua. Vayomurei Lav, and they told him, Al yal kol ha'am. Don't have the whole nation go. Kalpayim ish. Maybe like 2,000. Okshlosha salafim ish. 3,000 yalu. Let them go. Just that group. V'yakuas ha'ai, let them strike Ai. Al tiaga shama es kal ha'am. Don't exhaust the nation going. They're kima'at hema. Ai is small. We don't need it. We just conquered Jericho. They're getting more than confident. They're getting arrogant. Right? This is arrogance. And now, put that in the context of what you noticed about Pasuk Bet. They were told, go spy out the entire land. What they actually did was just go check out Ai. The arrogance is explicit in their advice to him, but it's also in their actions. If you take a look at source number 5, Malbim notes this. He says, Lo shilcham l'ragel Ai levada. He didn't send them just to seek out Ai. She rakes ha'aret, she ha'medina kula, the land, the entire region. Ai u'mekamos asher sviva, Ai and its surroundings. V'im ha'yum raglim kefi pekudasa, ha'yuroim ki arim rabim shcheinim l'sham. Had they actually done what he told them to do, they would have seen that there were neighbors. V'lo ha'yu amrim al yal sham kol ha'am, and they wouldn't have said, don't send the entire nation up. Right? They would have understood that there's a threat from the neighboring population. Avalheim shinu pekudaso, but they didn't follow the instruction. They did something different. So the attitude that they have towards the neighbors, is one that we're going to see also in the next pasuk.
So why didn't Yehoshua say something? If he instructed them, go see the land, and when they came back, they said, we went to the eye, why wouldn't he say, okay, and why didn't you go to the other city?
Did they tell him they had gone to the surrounding?
Well, they didn't ask about it. Well, they didn't ask anymore. We went to see the eye, right? Oh, they didn't. I don't think they gave
him any answers. Yeah,
but wouldn't they have been back in 2 days versus or like 3 months? Like they came back really quickly, probably after only just seeing one place.
Well, it's not that they have to see the whole country, right? They just need to see the area surrounding this city of Ai and investigate. For all Yehoshua knows, there's nobody around it. He doesn't actually know. All he knows is, I want you to check out the region, not just the target city, but check out the region. And they came back and said, you don't need anything. That's all Yehoshua is aware of. What the reason why they said it is because they didn't bother to check. We're fine. God's on our side. We'll be okay. We don't need to really make a big deal out of this. There's an element of overconfidence. There's an element of arrogance in this.
Why would they think this is different than conquering Jericho? Is Hashem giving them different instructions? Why would they not think that Hashem wouldn't be on their side?
Right. And maybe that's true. Maybe that's why they're arrogant. Maybe the feeling is, even though God has not told us anything about any strategy for a miracle, right? With Jericho, he gave them a whole strategy. He told them, you're going to go around the city for 7 days, and you'll take the Aron with you, and you're going to have the shofar, and you're not going to blow the shofar, and then on the seventh day, you will blow the shofar. Like, he gave them a whole story there. Here, he's told them nothing. Nonetheless, it's entirely possible that that's what's driving their confidence. Absolutely. They're feeling like, okay, next city, next miracle. So yeah, just send a few thousand. It could be that's what drives this.
The instructions are coming. Like this was kind
Who are these guys anyway?
Like they didn't they send a Jericho also? Mm-hmm. They sent Sarah with Jericho, and then Hashem gave them this whole plan. So maybe they just think it's like it's one of those like. Yeah.
Right. No, it's true. But this
is
what we call.
It doesn't matter that we do the spy thing because we did it in the handbook.
Right. It's just that it reflects a certain sense of entitlement. Right. You know, and that you're sort of taking for granted that the miracle is coming. And I think that is part of it because the Jews do need to learn, and it takes a little while, but they do need to learn that when they come into this land, they're not in the Midbar anymore. You know, where your bread comes down from the sky and the water comes from a rock. It's not going to work that way.
The protection comes from the clothes.
Yeah.
The protection comes from the clothes.
Right. And all of the above. So, it's true that could be what drives this. But number one, they need to learn that it's not so. But number two, it also reflects a sense of entitlement, a sense of taking it for granted. Like, okay, we know the miracle's coming. Yeah, sure, you can just tell us now what's going to happen this time. Where is God going to help us now?
Hashem speak anything to Yehoshua to make it clear? How are they supposed to really know? They've been living in this bubble, and now the bubble is bursting, but they almost have no warning.
True. There have been hints. I don't think there's anything explicit. There have been hints. So, for example, back in Sefer Devarim, Hashem says to Moshe, or Moshe tells the Jews, I should say, that Hashem is not going to wipe out all of the nations in the land for them just like that, because then there'll be a lot of wild animals around. So the fact that there's a concern like that, and not just, well, why doesn't God just take care of the wild animals, right? Tells you that things are going to be in a more natural way. Or when he talks to the nation about rain, and he says that, you're going to need to, you're not going to just have irrigation, naturally, this isn't Egypt anymore, right? Here you're going to depend on the rain, and the rain will come when you do the mitzvahs, right, as he tells
them. Human nature is such that we can't accept that until we live through it. So perhaps Hashem had to have them live through this for them to realize, the party's over, guys.
Right. But that's all great, they're setting this up that now, they're responsible to do things, but then their first encounter in a war is a huge miracle.
Yeah.
So it's kind of for naught.
Right, and I'm not...
It's like all these warnings, but then it's like the parent that, you're responsible, is responsible, and then you guys are doing it for them anyway, so...
Right.
Then you can't expect them to learn to be responsible.
Right. So what I would say is, this is not... when I say that they're overconfident or arrogant, I don't mean to express it in a... not that they're evil and they're sinful, as much as, yes, this is a natural consequence of the way things have been, but they're about to fall off a cliff. Because this is the time that they're not doing the homework for.
They're being pushed.
Yeah,
to a certain extent. Do they all know that Achan took from the spoils? Is there any clue that, hey, maybe we might get punished for this? Or is it just his wife and whatever?
Just his wife and kids from last week.
So they have no clue this is coming at all?
None. Whatsoever.
They have no clue that it's punishment, even.
Well, they don't know.
Remember, we talked about last week that pasuk before they crossed the Yarden, Hanistaro Hashem Elokeinu v'haniglot lanu ulevaneinu ad olam. That which is revealed is for us collectively to have responsibility.
But they don't know that he did it, so they wouldn't know that there's going to be a crisis.
Correct.
Right.
Correct. And that's what we have to give these explanations.
But they don't know. If nobody knows it, then they're not expecting it. So if they knew that he did something bad...
But the way it's written here is like ominous, like a foreshadowing. Like if you're reading a murder mystery, oh my God, something bad's going to happen.
Like the media gets made
of no. Right, no, the minor key, the violin, whatever. Yeah, like it's all screeching away.
The whole set.
Yes. Absolutely. So we now are ready for the story. This is going to be Yoshua's setback. This is going to be where the nation learns that things don't work here the way they worked on the other side of the Yarden. We're going to see the collective suffer for the actions of the individual. And here we go. Sukkim, Dalet, and Hey. Vayalu min ha'am shama kishloshes alafim ish. About 3,000 men went. So Yahushua is a little smarter, at least, than the spies. He took the high-end number. Vayanusu lifnei anshei ha'ai, but they fled from the people of Ai.
So they got their panic turned around.
Well, yes, that's the first thing that's remarkable here. It's not even like there's a battle.
They turned around.
They came, they left. That's it. They didn't even get to they saw. Vayakru mehem anshei ha'ai kishloshim v'shisha ish. And the people of Ai struck from them like or about, I don't know what the letter kaf is doing there, shloshim v'shisha ish, 36 men. Vayirdefum lifnei hashar ad hashivarim. They pursued them. The people of Ai pursued them before the gate of the city. Ad ha-shivarim, to the shivarim. Different explanations of shivarim. Shivarim could mean the foothills. Shivarim could also mean until they broke, like the word lishvor. Vayakum bamorad, and they struck them on the descent, as they descended. Because remember, this whole thing was an ascent, going up to Ai. So now they're down in the foothills and going downhill, and they're being chased all the way down by the people of Ai. Vayimas levav ha'am vayilamayim. The nation's heart melted, nation meaning not just the 3,000, but the Jews as a whole, turns to water.
Maybe they were crying.
Well, that's the same type of language we've used for the Canaan before.
They were crying.
Right? The idea of their heart melting is something that we've seen going all the way back to Az Yashir and Namogu Kol Yoshvei Canaan, but Vayimas Levaveinu, this is a phrase that Rachav used to when she spoke about the morale of the people in Yericho, but boom, suddenly everything is gone. All the excitement, all of the feeling of confidence, that's all shot. The nation is in ruins. Malbim makes this point about how they didn't even get to fight. It's like they got to the gate, and
freaked out.
Exactly. But I have a problem here. What is incongruous here with this whole idea of a route? The idea that this was a route, that they're really like driven back and ruined and so on. What doesn't fit that picture?
It was only 36 people.
Yeah. I mean, 36 out of 3,000? I mean, when I picture a route of a force of 3,000 people, I'm assuming you have at least triple digits in terms of the number of people who are dead. 36, it's not great. No one's happy about it. But it's odd for that to be the portrayal of such a devastating turnaround. Plus, the other question is, what's this cuff? When he said they sent...
36, right. A very specific number to be like...
Yeah. When it said he sent like 2,000, like 3,000, I understood, because maybe it's, 3,001. But what is like 36? Like 35? Like 30? Like 36 doesn't really fit. Yeah, twice high? No. So there are a couple of different approaches that are brought. The first approach is that, yes, 36 is a small number, but because they're so used to miracles, they're so used to wars after which Moshe is able to save Lo Nifkad Mimenu Ish, right, that nobody died, that anything is already shocking.
I didn't even get in. Before they got in.
Right. But also the 36. Even 36 is already very upsetting for them. Take a look at source number 6.
Not only have they lost 36, but they didn't just win like that.
Right.
Like they didn't get in. Turnaround.
Right. Take a look at Abarbanel. Abarbanel says, when Yehoshua is so upset, as we're going to see, Yehoshua v'chol hazakenim nitzta'aru ma'od mizeh. Yehoshua and all the elders were in great pain over this. Lo ambisas hashloshim v'sheish ish levad. Not only the death of the 36. Avol gam lefi shera'u sheneedra mehem ha'ashkacha ha'elokit. V'ayu ne'ezavim lemikre. But also because they saw that they had lost Hashem's supervision, Hashem didn't protect them, and that now they're vulnerable to happenstance. V'gam l'sherau morach levav ha'am, v'shenameis v'yolamayim. And it's not just that. They also saw the way that the nation itself had been affected. They saw the way that the hearts melted. V'im zeh lo yuchlu latzor koach li'lachim v'yvehem od, such that they would not be able to fight their enemies anymore because no one's even going to have the guts to go out to battle. Right? They're going to say, what, we want us to go fight somebody else now? Mm-hmm. So that's one approach, is that any loss is frightening. The other way that the commentators take it is that it was actually worse than a loss of 36, even if not reflected in the numbers. And there are two approaches within this approach. So all told, we're going to have three approaches, but bear with me. The Gemara in Sanhedrin suggests the following. Take a look at source number 7. Shloshim v'sheish ma'am v'shisha ma'amash divrei Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda says, 36. That was really what it was. It was really 36. But Amar lo Rabbi Nechemiah. Rabbi Nechemiah says, not so fast. V'chi shloshim v'shisha hayu. Was it really 36? V'halalo nemar ela ki shloshim v'shisha. The picks up the like 36. Ki shloshim v'shisha yish. Ela ze ya'ir ben Menasheh. Sheshakul kineged ruba shel Sanhedrin. He says it wasn't that. Rather, it was Yair ben Menashe who was lost. Because when you look in Chumash, you find a Yair, son of Menashe, as in somebody who really should have been gone for a long time by now. Yair is
that Yosef's descendant?
That's the one. Yosef's grandson.
Wow.
Because in Parshas Maaseh, we were told about him settling an area. Yair ben Menashe, halach, and so on. So the idea is that because we know that he's still alive, even at this stage, when did he die? When did he disappear? He died at this point. And he is considered to be equal to the majority of the Sanhedrin. So in the Sanhedrin, you have 71, so therefore the majority of the Sanhedrin is 36. There's more that goes into this Gemara. I didn't want to turn this into a class about this particular Gemara, so I didn't bring additional material on it. But there's more about this. But what they're suggesting is 36 is a magic number. 36 is the majority of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is 71, 36 is the majority of that, and that's what 36 is meant to represent. And that was what shook them up. It wasn't that they lost 36 people. It was actually because they lost one of their greatest. Somebody who was a throwback to an earlier time. Somebody who, you know, was there with them for centuries is what you'd have to be talking about.
How old could he be?
Sorry?
I was 7.
Yeah.
That's why he couldn't make it down the hill.
That's why they didn't send a Han, but they sent him.
Don't know. You're right. It's a good question. Why in the world would he have been in the 3,000? Like, if you had to choose 3,000, you don't really need to choose
maybe he's in really good shape.
The senior citizen. The,
maybe they were so confident.
And we're sure that there's no other Yair ben Menashe?
No, this is the Yair ben Menashe. That's the point. There's more to be said with it. I just didn't want to turn this into a shir about that particular medrash. But the message that we're getting is that it was someone who was the equal of 36, the equal meaning of the majority of the Sanhedrin, and that was what shook him. It was the righteousness of those who were lost. And then there's, again, I said there's a third approach that also fits with this idea that it's not really about 36 per se. This thing could have been worse, or should have been worse, really, according to Radak. What Radak is picking up on is, I mentioned this in Pasuk Bet, where it says, Mikedem leBeit El, east of Beit El. Does anyone remember where that phrase first shows up in the Chumash? It's in this week's parasha. The Vein Beit El shows up with Avraham when he builds his Mizbeach and he camps. Vein Beit El uBein Ha'ai. So, and even back then it was called Ha'ai instead of Ai. So the fact that the Pasuk here chooses to emphasize that is a throwback to Avraham camping there and building a Mizbeach. And what Radak suggests, if you take a look at source number 8, Amru Zal, he says, our sages said, I looked around, I couldn't find his source for it, so I brought it from Radak himself. Zichus Avraham Avinu Amdalahem Sham. Avraham's merit stood for them there. They were liable for taking from the spoils. They should have all been gone. And yet, I only struck 36 of them. Hashem protects them in the merit of Avraham and the Mizbeach that he built there. It should have been worse. And that's the idea of the 36 here, and that's why it's so frightening, because even with Avram's protection, nonetheless, we still lost soldiers. It wasn't a perfect protection. So what we get here in these psukim is, again, you know, two lessons. Number one is that the community is responsible, but number two, there's a separate point. Well, let me ask it as a question. Is there anything odd to this point in the Perek with what God does?
He doesn't do anything.
Doesn't do anything, meaning?
There's no instructions.
No instructions. What else?
He doesn't reprimand them.
For what?
Well,
not listening.
He doesn't
took
steps.
Right. He didn't tell them.
He doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
Give directions.
He just let them go out to war. Hashem knows full well that there's something wrong, right? And that they're going to get in trouble with these people and I because they don't have Hashem's protection. And he doesn't say anything.
Well, then, like a parent. And then one makes their own mistake.
Is that what it is? Perhaps this is part of the transition of the nation. You are no longer governed by miracles. You are now going to have to learn to manage on your own. It's time for the nation to grow up. And that's what he's trying to tell them. So the Jews are now shocked out of their arrogance by this rout, even if it was mitigated by Abraham's merit, and their new reality of a collective that's damaged by the sin of the individual and a collective that doesn't have access to divine messages all the time is suddenly thrown in their face. Well, if you're the Jews, how do you respond to this?
Rebel.
You call to God.
Cry.
Rebel, call to God, cry. Well, let's think logically. Let's go back to the analogy Leva gave before, right? The kid whose parents have always bailed him out the night before the assignment was due, right? So this time they said no. Okay? This time they said no, go to bed. Right?
Deal with it yourself.
Why didn't you do that?
Sorry?
Why didn't you help me?
Right. Why didn't you help me?
All the other times.
Right? The kid comes back and says, what happened? So that's what Yehoshua does. Take a look at Pasuk Vav. We get a nice speech here from Yehoshua, Pasuk Vav through Pasuk Tes. Vayikra Yehoshua simlo sav. Yehoshua tears his clothing. The word simla in biblical Hebrew does not mean a skirt per se or a feminine garment. Simla is generic. So Yehoshua tears his clothing. Vayipol al panav artza lifnei Aron Hashem ad ha'erev. And he falls to the ground in front of the Aron until evening. We don't know when he started, but it's meant to say for an extended period of time. Who? Viziknei Yisrael. Yehoshua does it along with the elders. Vayalu afar al rosham, and they put dirt on their heads. Vayomer Yehoshua, and Yehoshua said, I don't know if this is during the long period when he's lying in front of the Aron or this is after, but he says, aha, which is an expression of sadness and upset. Hashem Elokim, lama ha'avarta ha'avir es ha'am hazeh es ha'yardein, la'seis osanu biyado emori la'avidenu. Why did you bring this nation across the Yarden? To give us over to the Amori to destroy us? V'lu ha'alnu v'aneshe be'ver ha'yardein. Frankly, we could have stayed on the other side of the Yarden. Does it sound like...
It sounds like the thing. Why did you leave us in Mitzrayim?
Why did you bring us out of Egypt?
Yeah. But who is the one who usually says things like that?
The
Mitzrayim. Mitzrayim. That's not like a Moshe thing to say. Right? So he continues. He says, be Hashem, please God. Ma omar, what am I going to say? Acharei asher hafach Yisrael oref lifnei oivav. Now that the Jews have turned and run, oref is the back of the neck, they turn the back of their neck before their enemies, meaning they ran away. V'yishme'u haknani, v'chol yoshvei ha'aretz, v'nasabu oleinu. You know what the next step is? All those people who were afraid of us, who didn't want to fight with us, and who said, oh no, the Jews are coming. So they're going to hear about this, and they're going to turn around and attack us. V'chvisu ha'shmeinu min ha'aretz. They'll wipe out our name from the land. U'mata ha'aseh l'shimcha ha'gadol. And then what's going to happen, God, to your name? Maybe you're not worried about our name, but what's going to happen to your name?
This is an affront to his leadership. This is a test, perhaps, to his own leadership, because this is their first battle where they've lost, and where's, you know, Moshe's gone. Where's Moshe? All we have is Yehoshua. Look, Yehoshua isn't helping us enough.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yehoshua is on the firing line here. Everything that happens here is going to be seen as a challenge to his leadership. What do you think of his mode of addressing God here? I mean, we pointed out him saying, well, we could have stayed on the other side of the Yarden, right? That's one argument. What else does he say?
How could he say that to Hashem when Moshe spent his whole life dreaming and halishing and couldn't get over? How could... He was in despair, Yehoshua. It was like he wasn't thinking. It just came out of his mouth. Because how could he say that?
Okay. So... the question fundamentally is, so how can he do this? We have to see. There may be an answer. There's also, he uses the tack of, God, worry about yourself if not worrying about us, right? Your reputation, God. So, a few things.
Moshe used that also.
Moshe used it too. Absolutely. A few things here. First of all, go back to Pasuk Vav. Three classic behaviors of Avelus here that are found elsewhere in Tanakh, from Yaakov through Eov. Tearing clothing, falling in front of the Aron, which is falling to the ground in general, and putting dirt on their heads. It's interesting that the response here is to turn to God immediately. Meaning, I might have expected a military response. Like, okay, we sent out 3,000, they got routed, let's see what happens when we come back with 30,000. Right? They have many more soldiers. They had 600,000 men of military age.
They only lost 36.
Right.
Even those others that came
But look how he responded. Yeah. He, like, you know, tore Kriya and he's on the floor.
But that's the thing. The response is not a military response of, hey, let's multiply our force and then go back and rout them. And maybe the reason is because the nation at this point has completely lost their morale. But he turns to Davin.
Because they're not able to, they're not yet able to do a military attack without Hashem's.
They never
have
to do one by themselves.
They don't have that strength. They don't have the ability to rally together. They've never done a military attack. Yeah, look where it got them.
Yeah.
So they don't have the morale to do a military attack and feel confident that it's gonna. That's because they've never done that before.
True. And that you were gonna say?
Yeah, I think it's sort of emunah and recognition that Hashem is behind this. It's sort of like, you know, if somebody gives you instructions to do something and they're all powerful and you go and do what they said, that he's recognizing, he's being sensitive to the fact that Hashem must have done this for a reason.
Yeah, right. It's a very emunah-focused type of a response, and it's an outgrowth of what they did in the Midbar also. When anything happened in the Midbar, we're out of water, right? The answer wasn't, well, let's send some messengers over the next hill to try to find water. The answer was, God, you know, we need water. So it's true. This is they have this Hashem centered existence.
But it's very surprising that they even did this military attack by themselves.
Well, they had been told you're supposed to go conquer the land. Right? That was their job.
Right, but they weren't then given, like, Tana, they're given like piecemeal. Like it wasn't like go, so hey, great, we're supposed to conquer this whole thing, that's our job, but then they were told how to do your repo. And then, so the other, on the second, you would almost think that they would wait for that, how to do this one.
They picked Yericho, too. They picked Yericho as the target. Right? They sent the spies. And then, as they're camped outside Yericho, Hashem sends a malach to Yehoshua and the whole bit. And, you know, tells him what he's going to do. But fundamentally, Yehoshua was prepared to actually launch that attack. So there is that, you know, I think they do have a sense of responsibility for it. We're going to see later, when we get to sort of the string of wars that come, we'll see how Yehoshua actually has a strategy. This isn't just random, you know, enemy of the week. Last week was Yericho, and this week is going to be Ai. But he actually has a specific way of moving through the land with a goal in mind. So that we still have to get to. But actually, what I think Yehoshua is doing here is imitating Moshe in more than one way. It's true that, I think Beit said, that the part about, you know, God, it's going to be your reputation on the line, was something familiar from Moshe after the Egel. And in source number 9, I gave you the reference there in the 32nd parak of Shmos, Parshas Kisisa. You don't need to look that up, but look at the second reference there. That to me is the more interesting one. For those who have a Tanakh as opposed to just having Yehoshua, Shmos Perek Hei Psukim Chav Bet Chav Gimel. It's the end of, very end of Parsha Shmos. This takes place after Moshe has gone into Paro with all the miracles and the rod that's going to become a snake and the water turning to blood and the hand that shows Tzaras and all that. He's done his miracles for Paro, and Paro is unimpressed. Right? Paro says, I have magicians. They do stuff like that too. And instead, he actually says, let's double the people's workload, because clearly that's what's causing them to think about getting out. They must have too much time on their hands. They're dreaming that they're going to be able to escape. So Moshe goes back to God after this failure of an experience in the palace. And what does he say there? Yeah, 22, 23. Someone read out the English.
Moshe returned to Hashem and said, my Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why have you sent me? From the time that I came to Paro to speak in your name, he did evil to this people, but you did not rescue your people.
Right. He blames God. He says, what is this? Why did you send me in the first place? This is on you, God. Right? To which Hashem responds, saying, don't worry, little patience, you'll see what I'm going to do to Paro. All in good time, you know, next week's parasha, you'll find out. But the response that Moshe has is consistent with the response that Yehoshua has here. What did you send me for? Why did you bring us across the Yarden? And it's at the equivalent stage of his career. this was Moshe's first attempt, right? This was Moshe's very first foray into trying to get the Jews out of Egypt, and it was a bust, and he comes back to God and he says, I don't understand why you insisted that I do this. And now Yehoshua is following the same exact pattern. And after I saw that, I actually saw that, and I thought I was going to bring it on the sheet, but I see that I didn't. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Mem Daled, makes the same association and says, yes, this is mimicking what Moshe did. But I put it on here. Oh, well. Sorry, Tika, you were going to say?
Yeah, no, it's just kind of like a parent and a child, right? He goes a little bit, can't figure it out, comes crying back to the parents saying, I can't manage this, I can't do this, you know? Don't worry, you know, with more practice, he'll get it.
Well, it's more than that, though. It's more than I can't do this. It's a sense of betrayal.
Right,
because
God's not saying,
God's not
going to
say,
he's kind of
wrong, right? Right, this is, right, from here the situation changes.
He didn't say, like, okay, go try this on your own and see what happens. It was,
I'll take care of Pharaoh, I'll take care of God. He's not going to say that now.
Correct, because this is a different world. Right. The response to Moshe's claim, God, you betrayed me, is, don't worry about it, I have a plan. The response to Yehoshua saying, God, you betrayed me, is, well, actually, you betrayed me first. So yes, the responses are going to be different, but it's fundamentally the same point. When God first tells you to do something, and you go ahead and do it, and the result is a disaster, you come back to God and say, what'd you make me do that for? What is all of this about? Now, he turns to God and he says, Ma Omar, what am I going to say in Pasuk Ches, which I assume means, what am I going to say to the Jews? How am I supposed to rally the people at this point? They're going to have no morale. And in fact, if you take a look at source number 10, that's what Abarbanel sees here, right? Abarbanel writes in number 10, Vim Tomar, She'el Chamani, Kigibor Achayel, Mibli Ezer HaHashgacha. Yeshua says to God, if you're going to tell me that I should just go out and fight, then yeah, God won't support. There won't be divine supervision. Zebel Tiasharis, it's impossible. Sha'am kulo yarei v'charei v'ein lehem leiv lehilachem. They're all afraid. I don't have any warriors anymore. You can't expect me to go out and fight. So Yehoshua is saying, we have lost all confidence. I am not confident in my mission. The nation is not confident in their ability to actually settle this land. We have a problem. And Hashem's response is striking. If you take a look at Pasuk Yud, we'll start on this. We won't finish it all today. Pasuk Yud. Vayomer Hashem al Yehoshua kum lach. God says to Yehoshua, get up for yourself. We have to figure out what that means, but get up for yourself. Lama ze ata nofel apanecha. Why are you falling on your face exactly? Chata Yisrael. Israel has sinned. Vegam of ruas brisi asher tivisi osam, and they violated the covenant that I instructed them. Vegam lakchum anacherim, and they took from the spoils. Vegam gonvu, and they also stole. Vegam kichashu, and they also lied. Vegam samu bichleihem, and they also put it in their vessels. Yes, we have to address the question of what all these vegams are about and why this is being dragged out.
Until now, nobody, they didn't know anything that he.
Correct.
Well, it's only one, though, right?
Yeah. So
only one.
And Hashem says, I have news for you. This wasn't a one-shot problem. The Jews will not be able to stand before their enemies. They're going to continue to turn the back of their neck to their enemies. They're going to continue to run away. They will be this cherem. They took from the cherem. They will be like the cherem. They will be destroyed. It's a play on the word. Lo sifli yozi machem, I'm not going to be with you anymore. Im lo sashmidu hacherem mikir bachem, unless you get rid of this stuff from the spoils that was taken. How? Well, there's this fellow named Achan who took. No. Kum kadesh es ha'am. Go, prepare the nation. The amarta, hiskad shulamachar, tell them to prepare for tomorrow. Ki cho amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, because this is what God, the God of Israel, says. Cherem bekir b'cha Yisrael. The cherem is in your midst. That which you were supposed to destroy and not take, it's in your midst. Lo suchal akum lefnei vecha. You will not be able to stand before your enemy. Ad hasirchem hacherem bekir b'chem. Until you get rid of the cherem. And you know what? I'm going to actually go back to the opening couple of psukim instead of rushing forward into Yud Aleph Tesvav, because there's enough in Yud Aleph to Yud Gimel that, or even Yud-Alef Yud-Bet, for us to, or Yud-Ti Yud-Bet, that we need to see. Hashem says to Yehoshua, Kum Lach. It's an odd turn of phrase. Why don't you say Kum? Why don't you say get up? Kum Lach is strange. And indeed, last week we saw that there was a rebuke implied in Kum Lach. I brought you the reference in source number 11 to the pasuk from the beginning of Sefer Devarim. Hashem had said then that he's appointing Yehoshua, ki hu ya'avor lifnei ha'am hazeh, v'hu yanchil osam es ha'aretz asher tireh. Hashem said to Moshe, Yehoshua is going to lead. He will be the one who will go in front of this nation, and he will be the one to give them the nachala, to give them their share. And the Sifri, Medrash on that pasuk says that Hashem is saying, if Yehoshua is over lifnei ha'am hazeh, if Yehoshua goes in front of them, then hu yanchil osam, he will give them the land. But if Yehoshua doesn't go in front of them, it's not going to work. Yehoshua didn't go with them. He sent the 3,000. If you go back to Parashas Pinchas, you recall that Moshe requested of God a particular type of leader. Asher yetzei lifneihem, v'asher yavo lifneihem. He's got to go out in front of them. He has to come back in front of them. The Jewish leader is not allowed to send the soldiers and sit behind. He has to be sensitive to what's going on. He has to understand what's going on. He has to be willing to endanger himself as well. And so, there's a rebuke here to Yehoshua. Get up. What are you doing back there? This is because of you. To a certain extent, Yehoshua, this is your responsibility. That's one take. Rashi here offers another possibility. Remember, we had a long discussion back in the previous parak about why they put this stuff into Cherem. Why did they say that you weren't allowed to take from the spoils? Yehoshua received no such instruction directly from Hashem. And so, some of the commentators, like Abarbanel, said Hashem must have told Yehoshua. And he said, when Hashem told Yehoshua, take off your shoes because this is holy ground, he was saying, this is consecrated. You don't get to take this for yourself. So that was one explanation. Rashi here says no. Rashi says, you created something. You created a mess by doing this. Source number 12. He says, Bishvil chazoslem kum lach. Because this is because of you. Lo amarti lochala hakdish shalal hayir. I didn't tell you to consecrate the spoils. That was your decision. And it wasn't the right decision. Because inevitably, when you create new rules, and when you create restrictions like this, like don't take from the spoils, someone's going to break the rule, and now you have created a sinner. That's effectively what you've done. Had you never come up with this, we wouldn't be having the conversation. Kum lach, it's because of you, says Rashi. That's the opening of Hashem's statement. But then Hashem says to him, why are you falling on your face? You have work to do, right? The Jews have sinned and so on. That's a very odd beginning. As we've stressed here, Yehoshua doesn't know what's happened. So what do you mean? Like, what did you expect Yehoshua to do? He had no idea. It's a very odd kind of a reaction. It's a call to action, but what is this like? What is he supposed to be doing? In fact, going back to the parallels to Moshe, Moshe had a similar moment. The Jews are standing at Yam Suf. Because it's late, I'm not going to have you open up the Chumash to see it, but I referenced it in source number 13. But there, the Jews are standing at the sea. They say, we can't do this, we have to go back. Right? Let's go back and we'll serve Egypt. We can't. We're stuck. And Moshe turns to the Jews and rallies them. And he says, Hashem yilachem lachem ve'atem tacharishun. Hashem will fight for you, you just be quiet. And then the next pasuk, Hashem turns to Moshe and he says, Matitz akelai. Why are you calling out to me? Daber b'nei Yisrael v'yisau. Don't say Hashem yilachem lachem, God is going to fight for you. Tell them that they should get moving. Now, there's water in the way. But that's what Hashem says to Moshe. He says, get up and move. And you, Harimis Matcha, pick up the staff and hit the sea, or whatever it is he's going to do to the sea, pick up your matah, and then the water will split and so on. So what's going on here is that at the sea, Hashem told Moshe, why are you crying out to me? And in this war with Ai, Hashem says to Yehoshua, why are you crying out to me? And the answer in both cases is the same. We're turning to you, God, because we want your help. But Hashem is saying, I want you to act. And Moshe was supposed to be able to figure out, out to the sea, he's also a new leader at that point, they've never been out of Egypt, this nation. Moshe is supposed to figure out that he is supposed to take action and move the Jews forward and trust in God to take care of the water. And Yoshua is supposed to know on his own that if they lost this battle, that means Hashem isn't with them. If Hashem isn't with them, that's because they did something wrong. And it's his job to figure out what it is. It's Yoshua's job. He should have, instead of crying out to God, he should have taken the initiative to manage the situation. Now, this sounds like a very high expectation. I mean, it's one thing to say, figure out something was wrong and act on it, but then what do you do? Right? Is he going to know that what's wrong was taken from the cherem? How's he going to know that? It could be anything. It could be that somebody in the camp, I don't know what, right, stole from somebody else. It could be that somebody, anything you want to invent. How does, you know, maybe one of them, you know, has an Avodah Zarah hidden away. How is he even going to know what he's supposed to do? But this is the problem with being Moshe's replacement. He's not just anybody. He's not one of us sitting around the table. He's Moshe's replacement. And if you are going to be the leader of this nation, you have to have more skills than that. You have to be able to determine what, you know, what to do in a situation like this. And that's what Hashem does. Now, the truth is, in the next pasuk, Hashem gives Yoshua, you know, sort of a way to get moving on this. He doesn't abandon him entirely. But that's the expectation Hashem has for Yoshua. You're going to lead. You have to be able to figure stuff out. It's really you know.
It's just so, like, 180. Like, from holding the hand.
Yeah.
And doing everything to all of a sudden, without warning, like, sorry.
Yep, and that's the transition. You cross the Yarden, and that's exactly
but
what it is.
But he crossed the Yarden, and the first time he didn't have to do anything. So,
true.
So it's not like everything just changed.
Right. No, that's true. You have you had the miracle.
Kindergarten, you got to walk to school, and then grade one, you're like lucky.
I don't know if it's high.
Right. No, it's true. Understood. So the upshot of all of this is the theme that we're seeing is this theme of becoming a nation and becoming more independent, and. We sort of haven't seen the second half. We're only seeing the disaster part of it right now. But Hashem very much saying that you're going to need to be the ones to proceed. Yoshua wants to turn to Hashem, and Hashem says you're going to have to be the one to work this out. We'll see more about that, God willing, next week.
Okay.
Thank you.